Well, good evening, everybody. This is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 67. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Our guest in just a little bit is Brian Sonia Wallace here on Skype. But before we begin, I should say that Rattle is a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry. We've been a continuous publication since 1995 and are unaffiliated with any other organization. If you love poetry as much as we do, please click on the like button and share and all that good stuff, because that's how the computers know to share the content that we're doing. So if you click something, computers will know that you like this, and then they'll show it to other people who might like this, and then more people will like this, and then the poetry liking just has this whole snowball effect, and that's excellent. So do that right now. If you're not subscribed, subscribe now, and we'll be good to go. So for the warm-up poem today, as everybody gathers around and gets ready for a great night of poetry, I want to let everybody know that the deadline for the Rattle Young Poets Anthology, which is an anthology of poems by poets age 15 and younger, and it comes as a chapbook with a summer issue of every Rattle. The deadline for that is December 1st. We moved it up a couple weeks because I forgot to send my reminder email about it, to be honest. But I did, and so let's move the deadline up a little bit. And the deadline's going to be December 1st. So if you know of any young poets who are age 15 or younger, it's an excellent way to break into publishing. And it's just beautiful to see the way that kids write and engage with the world. Kids are so insightful and have surprising sort of how much they absorb and how much they understand and have to say. And so I thought for the warm-up poems, I will do two because they're really short. And this is from the first Rattle Young Poets anthology. These are... this first one is Chloe Ortiz. Here we go. This is, she's age 14, and this is Twine, A Prayer, from the 2014 Rattle Young Poets Anthology. Twine, A Prayer. God is a rope, long and thick. It pulls us out of the water. The roughness burns our skin. We continue to climb. The waves are still splashing. Our hands are red, and we shout to God. We feel his leniency, strong and continuous. Then, with a flick of his wrist, we are flung back into the sea. And that's Chloe Ortiz, age 14, Twine, A Prayer. Just an amazing poem. I mean, we get submissions like this. If you've read the Rattle Young Poets anthologies, you know how amazing these kids are. And this may be my favorite one. This is Frank Colasacco. And his father, John Colasacco, is a poet too, and sort of followed him around with a recorder. And his son, Frank, would say, I'm going to write a poem now, Dad. And then he would recite this. And then Frank would just transcribe it. Or John, I should say, would transcribe it. So this is Frank Colasacco, age 3, from the 2014 Rattle Young Poets Anthology. This is Bob the Bear. Bob the Bear breaks himself, and some balls come out. And that lamp comes out, and a daddy comes out, and a hammer comes out, and a nail. And Bob the Bear hammered the nail and fixed himself. That is Bob the Bear by Frank Colasacco, age 3. So, I have kids who, my kids are 6 and 10 now. But they write amazing poems, and they've been in the Rattle Young Poets Anthology too, I have to say. But if you know kids who write poems like these, don't let them go to waste. Don't put them in a drawer. Send them on to Rattle by December 1st, and we'll publish some of them in the Rattle Young Poets Anthology coming up. Now, let's get on to our featured poet for today. Brian Sonia Wallace is the founder of Rent Poet, and his new book, just out, I'll put on screen right now, is The Poetry of Strangers, right here. It's a beautiful, he calls it a book of essays, but it feels like a memoir. And I really enjoyed reading it today. I spent the entire afternoon reading it. It's a great book. So check it out here from, who's it from? Harper Perennial. And Brian Sonia Wallace in 2012 set up a typewriter on the street with a sign that said Poetry Store and accidentally started his business, Rent Poet. Over 5,000 poems later, his book of essays, The Poetry of Strangers, profiles the communities he's written for across America and the desperate desire to be listened to and heard that he found. Excerpts have been published in The Guardian and Rolling Stone. He's been the official writer-in-residence for unlikely clients like Amtrak and the Mall of America. Brian Sonia Wallace has also just been named Poet Laureate of West Hollywood. And here he is, Brian Sonia Wallace. How you doing, Brian?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. Do you want to start out with a poem just to kick it off and get sort of in the spirit of literature?
I will. I was thinking about what to kick things off with, and I think this is the right mix of sort of perverse and not too far kind of up itself. A lot of these poems that I'm going to read tonight were written for other people at a typewriter. And because we're on video, I'll do that and show the mandatory gimmick. And so this poem I think was written at the Bootleg Theater in LA, like late night at one point. Someone came up and asked for a eulogy. So people come up to me at the typewriter at different events and things and ask for poems. And didn't have a specific eulogy that she wanted, but wanted a eulogy. So this is eulogy for a poem. Cause of poem, unknown. Time of poem, 8:18 p.m. Rest in poem, poem. No priest, no scientist, no daughter, mother, warrior, no breath. I scalpel, I formaldehyde, cutting away extraneous moments, preserving entrails, raising them up, giving them voice. Here lies poem, survived by us all.
Excellent, Brian. So, do you want to start out too by just telling the story of how this came to be? Like it was 2012. So, paint the scene here. It's 2012. Where did you end up with a typewriter, first of all? Was that something that you always had? Did you always write in a typewriter, or was that something new too?
No, it was a totally new thing. So I am a sort of mid-generation millennial, and had totally I'd kind of come of age with the internet, and had never used a typewriter until 2012. And the first time I ever actually, I think this may or may not be factual, but I'm going to say it. The first time I ever used a typewriter was doing this practice, was writing poems for other people. So they're really closely associated in my mind with that. And I actually had I'd come back to LA, had finished school, and I really wanted to be a theater director. That was kind of what I was dreaming of. And there was a theater company that had a theater truck, because it's LA where one side of the truck folded down into a stage. They were doing something at a festival, and they said, "Well, come do something at our truck stage." And I didn't have anything to do, but I had heard a story about someone doing this with a typewriter, and so they had a typewriter that they let me borrow. And I sat up next to the truck stage into like a solar powered DJ at a metro opening in downtown. And that was the sort of beginning of it all. And then it took me a while to get my first typewriter. I did a lot of little, like, I thought of them as like urban interventions. Like, I'd get together with friends in the park and we'd like write poems and we'd post them on like street poles around the city. So these ways of trying to engage, using poetry as a tool to engage with other people, which I think that I'm suspicious of poets sometimes because I'm like, you are using this tool to engage with yourself, and that is valuable, but how are you engaging with, other folks?
Do you remember where like the idea came from to go actually on, and busk with poetry? Was there something that sort of triggered that for you and said, "Hey, that's something I could try."
I mean, really, it was the whim of doing it once, and then I did it a couple of times. Was sort of like, oh, these typewriters are fun. And then in 2014, I'd gotten laid off from sort of two jobs in a short period of time and was looking and interviewing and coming up second in all the interviews. And I got to the end of about 6 months and was considering taking a minimum wage job at a candle store to just pay my rent. And I'd been like doing a lot of Kickstarter fundraising for plays. And I was like, I bet I could do like a poetry Kickstarter. So that was really how I first thought about it. I was like, can I pay my rent for a month with poetry? This month, limit that Kickstarter has seems to work to like make you do things and also make other people respond. So that was really how it started. And then at the end of the month, I was like, well, I'm done with this. Like, I'll go back to making theater. And people were like, no, we want you to be the poet guy. And I'm like, I guess I'm the poet guy. Okay.
So in the story, in the book, you tell the story of the very first poem you wrote, which I think everybody's probably interested in. Do you want to, can you tell that story too here?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, let me, can I read it?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
I said it better. So this is the book, it's The Poetry of Strangers. I think it's also in something.
And let me know the page you turn to, and I'll turn it to so people can read along.
Amazing. So I think we're starting on page 3.
Okay.
And this is a bit of essay, but it was fascinating working on this, or memoir as you call it. It was fascinating working on this, writing lots and lots of poetry and then suddenly switching in a huge way to nonfiction. And it was interesting to see the things in this that came. I mean, all of the essays come from the poems, and some of the poems are embedded in the essays as sort of like almost rough drafts, mm-hmm. is almost how I think about it sometimes. Anyways, page 3. I idly typed on a piece of paper to calm my nerves. No sooner had I started writing than people drifted over, curious to see the typewriter and then bemused at the prospect of finding a self-proclaimed poet behind it. "Do you need a poem?" I asked them from under my Newsy-style flat cap. I'd done acting and wore this hat like a costume, like armor. I wasn't me, I told myself over and over again. I was the character of the poet. If people rejected me, they weren't rejecting me. They were rejecting this character that I was playing. But people stopped almost immediately. Old folks to reminisce over the typewriter, curious kids and their parents, couples on dates. I asked each of them the same question. "Do you need a poem?" "I don't have any money," replied a buzzcut Chicana woman with tattoos peeking out wherever clothing met skin. "That's okay," I replied. "About my dad, then?" Her answer was instant. He was a long-haul trucker when my brothers and sisters and I were growing up, so he wasn't able to be around much. She drifted into stories of her dad, her family, reminiscing about her life and relationships to a complete stranger on the street while throngs of people passed. My dad would be gone for weeks at a time. But he'd do it to be able to send money home, she told me. I just want him to know that I understood, and that we loved him for it. She stopped and stood in silence. I wondered if this story was a weight she'd been carrying for a long time. My fingers struggled to muster up enough force on the rusty keys of the typewriter in front of me to smash the tiny hammers into the ink ribbon and onto paper. I quickly discarded the 10-fingered typing we'd been assured in school was the secret to success and went back to hunt and peck. As I typed each line, the typewriter would skip ever perilously closer to the edge of the cheap TV tray table, threatening to topple off. I'd have to pause to wrestle it back, turn the knob, pull the carriage back, start a new line. The C stuck. The space bar sometimes skipped and left two spaces. Any hope I had at formatting the thing was gone. It would format itself, thank you very much. My index fingers labored over the keyboard, each keystroke an exclamation of permanence. I didn't keep any, just a little bit more in this story. I realize how long essays are when you read them. Oh my goodness. I will say I have one poem that you published in Rattle last year as part of the Instagram Poets edition. And it was a typewriter poem. And it is really cool in writing them that you can have some intentionality with getting to the end of a line, but really the lines end where your paper ends. And I write on sort of 3x5 cards, so there's not much space. I love those sorts of constraints in the mm-hmm. writing. Okay, the end of The Trucker's Daughter. I didn't keep any pictures of the poems I wrote back then, so I'll never know what the first poem I wrote for a stranger said. I remember images of truck side mirrors, endless lonely roads, buoyed by thoughts of family back home, the road itself becoming a vein through which blood flowed back to the heart. And I remember reading the poem to this fierce woman, peeking up to see her eyes closed. It was a first draft. Imperfect, riddled with the errors of a 60-year-old machine and a 22-year-old poet, but it was hers. At the end, she took a deep breath in, then opened her eyes and looked at me. She took her poem, expression inscrutable. "Wait here," she said, and vanished into the crowd. I moved on to write for someone new, a middle-aged woman in festive summer clothes who fawned over photos of her dog with me at the typewriter. But then the trucker's daughter reemerged from the mass and pressed a crisp bill into my hand. I had to go to an ATM, she told me, by way of explanation. Her tone was gruff, but I could see something had softened in her face. The trucker's daughter didn't look like she had much, but her $5 was much more than $5 to an unemployed kid looking for something to hold on to. It was an affirmation. In this world bound by money and scarcity, this world where it's hard to find the words to tell someone how you feel, what you mean, she was sending me a message. What you are doing is worth something.
And that was from the first essay in the Poetry of Strangers by Brian Sonia Wallace. I think later, maybe in that essay, if I remember right, you mentioned that what you realized there was that poetry could be a kind of service industry, I think is how you put it. So what do you think the service is that you're providing? I think that's the most fascinating thing to me. Like, why do people come up and want you? Like, it seems, you mentioned several times, like, being nervous about whether or not somebody would actually want to have you write a poem, you know? And then it sounds like, reading the book, that no matter where you go, everybody always does. So why do you think that is? Like, what is, like, the actual service that it is? And why is there, like, a need for that? That's, like, the fascinating thing about this book and this subject to me, is just that like, need that we have. But for what? What do you think it is?
I mean, I think it's, in the way that I do it, I think about it as a cross between, like, therapy and fortune telling. And I think that there are elements of both of those things in there. But I think that the big thing for me is that it's about listening to the other person. Like, one of the things that I find the most fascinating is what I write really has very little impact on the reactions that people have. So people aren't necessarily reacting to my writing. What people are reacting to is the act of being asked what they want a poem about and then being listened to be like, what is your, I don't know, what's the poetry changes nothing? Like, to be asked, what is the thing that you think, that you love, that you hate, that you're working on, that changes nothing, but that you're working on, that maybe you're not sharing with anybody else? And so there's this sense of, I think, you know, it's not like deeply held secrets. I've had a couple of people tell me really profound things, but mostly they just talk about their families or their dogs or the future and what's coming up or how stressed they are. Like, it's sort of just like the unspoken day to day that I feel like comes into that. And that I do think, I mean, you know, it's cliche to say at this point because we're in quarantine. It's, you know, we were already shouting that we were disconnected and isolated and all that crap before quarantine. And now we're like, well, more of that.
Yeah. Do you want to read, you know, read another poem and maybe tell another story about it? Or what do you want to do next?
Where to go from here?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. I try to, like I get in trouble with these podcasts where I just want to talk, but then everybody says, where's the poems? We want poems if we talk too much. So let's share some other poems too.
Sounds good. So I'll do a poem from the book that's in one of the essays. This is page 61. And so one of the sort of bizarre things that happened as a result of setting up like a scamp on the street with a typewriter is that I started being able to say, well, I do this weird thing. And it wasn't necessarily like traditional literary places that were receptive to that, but it was everyone else. And so ended up doing like corporate gigs for all sorts of like tech companies and working with the national parks and working as did a residency on Amtrak, which is in the book, and then a residency at the Mall of America, which is a mega mall in Minnesota. It has a full amusement park inside of it because it's the frozen north and everything has to be inside, which is frightening at this moment. And yeah, it was the mall's 25th birthday. They were like, well, having a writer residency for our 25th birthday. And the media was like, you're not books. Sit down. And I was like, I do a fun thing where I have a typewriter. And they were like, sounds good. So I sent pictures with my application, like nothing that you would be able to do at a traditional, you know, poetry establishment. This poem is for the guy who was the head of PR, who was my sort of de facto boss while I was at the mall, my poetry boss. Poetry Daddy. And he talked about his son, and he had been a single dad and had raised his kid solo growing up, and they were really, really into Disney World. Like, everyone at the mall is super Disney fanatics. And I asked what their favorite Disney story was, and he said Peter Pan, the boy who never grows up. So that's what you need to know for this poem. And I should say the titles of all of these poems are just the people's names that they're written for. So it's pretty common. And maybe if I go back and revise it more, I would change it and mess around with it. But this is terrifyingly and permanently a first draft. For Bryce, who never stopped believing in fairies, even when all the evidence pointed in the opposite direction. We were lost boys, both of us, growing up together despite our best intentions. Nothing gives me more pride than seeing you with Franklin, the grandkid, taking the time to teach him to fly. Every parent's wish is for their kid to grow up, to be better than they were. As you begin your journey into fatherhood, I am beaming. We have faced our crocodiles. They will not stop us from coming back for more. There is no one I would rather not grow up with than you.
And that was for Bryce from the Mall of the Americas section of the book. I should say, if anybody has any questions for Brian Sony Wallace, just leave them in the chat windows. To remind everybody, I am watching Facebook and YouTube, but not anything else. So if you're watching anywhere else, you can't leave questions. Go find YouTube or Facebook, because I can only have so many windows open at once. But I'm happy to pass along any questions that we have for Brian Sony Wallace. So Brian, one of the interesting things is the sort of the constraints that you have writing poems in this way. Like, not only are you like given the subjects, but you're also confined to the size of the paper that you're using. Did you say it's a 3x5 card, I think? Is that what you said?
I have a confession. I started on 3x5, but I've moved to 4x6.
Oh, wow. Your secret is out now. Yeah. So, but you're constrained by that size and sort of also pleasing people too, right? Like, you're writing in a way that you're trying, as opposed to like, I think most poets, when they write, it seems like, just talking to them, over the years, they're writing to sort of please themselves, like for their own delightment at like the way they're playing with language and like the little leaps of their imagination. But you're not doing that, which is very uncommon among poets. You're trying to make somebody happy with your poem, I assume, right? So how does that like change the way that you write? Like what are the typewriter too, with the line length and things like that? Do you find that you have like a style and like a thing that you go to? How does that all like play out as a poet, you know?
Yeah. Oh man, that's I hadn't thought of it in quite those terms before, but it's totally, I've been thinking over the last couple of days, I'm like, I think I'm a people pleaser. And then I'm like, yeah, like this is the epitome of that, right? Something that I talk about when I teach. So one of the, another thing that has come out of being a weirdo on the street with the typewriter is people saying, yeah, I trust you with kids. I've been teaching for a number of years now, but, I work as the manager of education at Get Lit, which is a mostly spoken word youth organization here in LA. And, one of the things I always tell the students with their poems when they're writing is take care of your audience. And I think it's something that really comes from more of the performance poetry side of the world rather than the page poetry, because in page poetry, you can kind of read through pages and pages and have a few poems of sadness and a few poems of uplift and different things. But when you're performing, you're really building a narrative arc for your audience. You're going to take them on a journey, right? You're going to start off angry, and then you're going to have a moment where it gets serious and self-reflective, and then you're going to leave them on an uplifting note. And so I think I have this, because I have this performance background, I think in that way kind of naturally. And so when I'm thinking about, and I've been working more with composers and writing more for music, and I'm like, I think, and taking classes in poetry, which is I hadn't done before, it makes me very embarrassed about my writing, because people are really good and thoughtful. But I think I make poet, like, first and foremost as an improviser and as a musician. Like, I'm interested in rhythm. I'm interested in sort of the journey of the poem. And then if we're talking about, like, clever moves with language or, you know, really fresh metaphors or any of that stuff, like, that's the newer territory for me. That's where I'm still really cutting my teeth. But that idea that what you're doing is you're sort of playing someone a song, and, like, you don't have to have the song all the way written, but you know if you shout in their ear, you better have a good reason to shout in their ear. And, like, in some contexts, that's appropriate, but not all of them. And sometimes I do. Some of my poems are I occasionally will give people a lecture in their poem. But that's equally an intention toward an audience, right?
So Danny Mask here asks, very specific, how long does it take you to write a poem? Like if you're set up there, say, at the Mall of America, how much do you like assign a certain amount of time? And then do you take notes when you're talking to the person? Do you write a first draft while you're talking to them? Just like, how does it actually work? I think everybody's curious. I'm curious too. How does like you talk to somebody and they tell you like their life story or what they, you know, what they want to be saved in a poem or whatever. And how does the actual process work, and how long does it take too?
I love the how long does it take question, Danny. It's what, like, all event organizers want to know, because this is mainly who I'm talking to about my poetry is event organizers, and their main question is how fast do you write it? Which I think is an interesting metric to be judged by as a poet.
Yeah, well, if you took, like, you know, like 2 hours to write each poem, then it really wouldn't work for a corporate office party.
Right?
Yeah.
I tend to say it's 10 to 15 minutes a poem if I have a huge line. Mm-hmm. Which is a great problem to have as a poet. I can bang out like four to eight line sort of pithy to profound one metaphor, one story, and we're done. I can do those in probably 3 or 4 minutes. But I mean, it's interesting to think about time as a formal constraint as well. And the poems that I write in 3 minutes when there's a long line and I'm like, you know, and often there's like a DJ playing right next door, so the person sort of shouting their story at you and you're kind of listening and then typing, and that makes it's just a very noisy, like, clamorous process, which I think is very different from most poets' writing conditions. And I'm an eternal procrastinator, so I think it really helps me to be like, you have 3 minutes to write this poem and this person's going to watch you. Don't take another sip of your coffee. Don't go to the bathroom. Don't make a sandwich. Write your dang poem.
So they're actually sitting there watching you most of the time? Like they're watching you type away? That seems like so much pressure. I can't even imagine.
And often they continue to talk to him. Like, and that's my favorite thing actually. Oh, really? Is like you'll get a juicy detail from them. You'll be like 3/4 of the way through the poem and you'll get stuck and they'll still be telling you their life story or telling you like more nuances of one thing, and you're like, oh, there's an image from that. Oh, the canoe? When you were on vacation in Canada, the snow-capped mountains. Yes, that's how this poem ends.
Oh wow, that's so cool. Because I have this like thing where I feel like if I'm going to be interrupted, I find it really hard to write. Like if there's the possibility, so I try to write after everybody goes to bed because like nobody's awake, no one's going to interrupt me and like break up my flow, and I have some weird like anxiety about that while I'm writing. But that it seems like a great exercise at least to get rid of that sense. You know, you hear people writing in cafes and stuff like that, and saying how the noisy commotion ends up being a positive. It's just hard to imagine that. Another thing I'm wondering too, reading the book, do you have are there times where you're like really proud of your poem and you have like a different reaction to it than the person who's receiving it, or are you sort of on the same page? Like, are you sort of embodying the person? Is there ever like a mismatch? Do you ever think like this person's really going to love this poem and then they don't, or like vice versa? You're like, oh, I'm having so much trouble. And then they love it. Does that happen too?
Yeah. Every now and then I'm being paid to write for a party whose primary purpose is to appear on Instagram. Like it's a photo op, you know, uh-huh. And I'm like part of the photo op, and like, people will come get poems and I'll like be in the mood to work. Cause sometimes I'm also not in the mood to work. You know, sometimes I'm like, I've got a metaphor about a ship and an ocean and a mountain. And like, maybe someone's the captain. And that's sort of what we're doing tonight. Like my brain has those things on lock. And sometimes I'm like, but what if there's, you know, a cactus and a cartwheel and a flamingo, and try to surprise myself a little bit more. And the worst mismatches are when I'm trying to surprise myself and the people who are there are like, and this is usually like 1 in 10 people, maybe. Like, people by and large are really lovely about poetry when approached in this way. But every 1 in 10 person, 1 in 10 person? That's grammatically terrible. Yeah. Every 1 in 10 people, I guess. Yeah. The one person in the 10 people will sort of be like, oh, like, thanks. And sort of wander away, and I'll be like, no, did you not see the freshness of that metaphor? Did you not see the amazingness of that line break? And often I like my writing for formal reasons, where the person who's receiving it is really hearing their story. And often, sometimes the story gets in the way of writing, like, sometimes there are too many metaphors and they all jostle next to each other, or too many images because they've been telling me their whole life. Mm-hmm. Or they've told me nothing, conversely. They've been like, want a poem about love? And you'll ask them follow-ups and they'll be like, just love. Are you in love? Are you looking for love? What's going on with love with you? Oh, you know. But then they usually do open up. Like, if you follow up with them, even those people tend to slowly divulge.
So Mary Ellen Carr over on Facebook asks a related question, kind of. She says, are there poems that you were embarrassed to give to somebody? Are there any poems that you seem to write more about yourself than them? Like, does that come up where you sort of identify so much and you're writing about yourself?
At all times. I have, so one of the things that kind of led to the WeHo laureateship is 2 years ago, I worked with the city to start up a group called Pride Poets that does this practice, but kind of on scale at Pride. So we've got like 15 queer poets now who I'll take to the streets with typewriters in June. And one of the Pride Poets, Natalie, says it brilliantly, and it's in the book, but she says, I talk to the person until I find myself, and then I write that. And I love that idea so much, that there is what you are looking for in that other person is just that connection, is that point of connection. And that's the thing that I think the book is about, in that like weird intangible way where you can't really say it. It's like, how do you find that connection? What does that look like to sort of see yourself into someone? There was a second part to that question, right?
The first part was, are you embarrassed to give somebody the poem that you do? Do you ever feel that way?
All the time. And the best, this is the other mismatch, Tim. The best is when they like weep and they're like, oh my God, I'm going to cherish this forever. I'm going to give this to my, you know, mother. This is going to be so meaningful in my life. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like that, I, you know, I was 12 poems in and that one just didn't come out well.
Yeah. Well, I have so many questions for you, but I don't want to skip like sharing poems too. So let's do another poem first. What do you want to do next?
I feel like this is sort of appropriate in talking about this, where this is a poem that I wrote. And immediately after I was like, oh, that's, you know, that came out well. And it's the poem that Rattle published last year.
Oh, okay. I'll find it.
Do you want me to, I can chat you the link or?
No, I have it right here. It's a good game. Okay, cool. Yeah, go ahead. So introduce it and then go ahead.
Cool. So this one, it's called My Gift is the Sculpture, which is just the first line. But I was doing an event with Pen America, writing poems outside, and it was over. And this always happens whenever I tell, this is the other, it takes five, like, you know, 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes to write the poem, but also the event where you say you're going to write poems for 3 hours, you always write for 4 hours and sometimes 5 hours. And there's a sort of like trance state that I think you can go into in doing that, that I find really liberating and cool. And you start playing with things because you're boring yourself with your normal crap. So yeah, this woman comes up to me after and I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, we're actually done. And she says, oh, that's fine. I was going to give you a sad topic anyway. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, no, you have something you need to tell me. And she talked about her husband who had really recently passed away, and she was grieving him. One of the sort of groups I've gotten to be friends with in the last couple of years is hospital chaplains, because I think that there's some, that was the third thing. It's a therapist, fortune teller, chaplain is kind of the trifecta where I'm like, I think I'm between these things, because it's sitting with people's, it's sitting with what people are going through. It's walking with people on their road and not being judgmental about it. So yeah, her husband was a sculptor and this was the poem for him. My gift is the sculpture no one bought. Clay me in your molding, and when you're gone, I'll find myself fired quite unexpectedly. I'll mix my media until I can't tell glass from steel, until I don't know where you end, where I begin, except that you are gone and I am still just brittle shapes and colored beads. It's okay. Sad, anyway. Years of strokes, gifts, built up great variety. It's okay. October is okay. When your shape is fixed, all a sculpture can do is lose a nose or arm. The museum doesn't replace them, just displays in as-is condition, just calls the collection antiquities.
And there's My Gift is the Sculpture from Rattle number, what number was that? That was Rattle number 64, the Instagram Poets issue, because of course, as Rent Poet, at Rent Poet, Brian Sonia Wallace has a Instagram page where he posts a lot of these stories and poems, just a wonderful thing to do. I feel like kind of like geeking out a little bit here, because I feel like I I'm sort of like studying the structure of poetry, like in a lab here. Like I get these like samples in and then I'm trying to see like what's going to work in the world. And like, but then love you that. Are like Jane Goodall out with the gorillas, you know,
people,
what I'm trying to figure out, like what poems are people going to like love and appreciate and remember for the rest of their lives? You know, like that's what we want to do at Rattle. And I'm trying to sort of always juggle this, like make it creative and interesting for people who like read a lot, but also find poems that are interesting for people who don't read much poetry. And there's one section in the book where you mentioned there's like four features of a poem that works. So I just maybe expand on that, but like what makes a poem work for people? Like which poems do you think are successful and like why? For regular people that don't usually read poetry, it's just such a fascinating thing to me.
Here's my formula. I talk about it a little bit in the book. I think that, and I came up with this like way at the beginning, which is funny, but it's kind of stuck in my head. You have to have something familiar so that people can see themselves in the poem. And even like that poem, there are so many moments where I find myself tempted to like stop reading and comment on it. Because I'm like, oh, you don't know this, but she actually was a bead worker. Her husband was a sculptor. She was a bead worker. He was never commercially successful, but like loved the art. Like there's this backstory that comes with each of these poems. That's not, my intention isn't to tell that story to anyone else. It's the person reading the poem comes with that context. And so the words mean something different to them. But something familiar, something surprising. So just the opposite, something that kind of, you know, makes you wake up. Something beautiful so that you know that it's poetry. I think a lot of people, if you're just like some of the very like conversational poetry that I read now, that's brilliant and technical and awesome. And I'm like, this is an essay with line breaks, you know, people don't recognize it because it doesn't have the tree with the red flower and it doesn't have the crane on the lake and it doesn't have the orchid. And like, have the orchid. Why not? You can have an orchid. Something's familiar, something strange, something beautiful, and a joke. And that's my final element. I think every poem, if you want people to, I guess it comes back to the people pleasing, right? Like if you want people to like you, you have to be willing to almost make fun of yourself, mm-hmm. or to play a little bit, or to show that you're not, even if the theme is serious, like the theme of the last poem is quite serious. But there's still some sort of surprising turns of language that in my head at least are lighthearted, where I'm like, this is kind of a fun sentence, you know, it's not all It's not all that sound.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that the reason why that's so important, and I just found this fascinating, is because it sort of lets people know that it's not taking itself too seriously. And there's a way, sort of in this culture, at least in this era, where poetry is up in this ivory tower. And I think the reason why people don't allow themselves to appreciate it is because they think that it's too lofty and maybe like over their heads, or maybe, you know. And so the adding of a joke, you know, like brings it down and like makes fun of itself, and sort of lets it all be lighthearted. I thought that was such a great insight into what works.
And I think depending on the joke, like some of, not as much anymore, but like certainly at the beginning, a lot of times, like whatever music I was listening to would make its way into the poem. And it was like top 40s hip hop radio hits. You know, it was not anything super obscure or cultured. And having that point of connection, I think there's this like meeting people where they're at, that I think that particularly with poetry, because people aren't taught to read the line breaks, and like we just, they're so scary. You know, unless you really are like, okay, two lines and then two lines, and oh, this word's here, and what does that mean? Like, it's puzzles. It's like word nerds, right? But I love the idea that all of that kind of like laboratory, you know, there's like the lab science, and then there's the inventions that kind of people are using, where it's like, well, I needed a vacuum, so great that we know about suction. But those people aren't necessarily the same. So I think I'm the vacuum maker, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, one thing that I would imagine, you know, with my little petri dishes here, is that I would imagine that your most common response to poems is, "Hey, this doesn't rhyme." Does that happen a lot? Because I haven't come across, I don't think many of your poems rhyme, if at all. And I get that from, you know, like I try to get copies of Rattle to like our plumber, you know. I'd be like, we have a book of, you know, you should read this poem about plumbing. You know, we have a great poem about the plumber's nightmare. And our plumber was over here, you know, a couple of years ago, and I gave him that, and I was like, you should read that poem. And he said, you know, well, it doesn't rhyme.
I know what a poem is.
Yeah. So do you get that a lot, or do people sort of understand, you know, modern free verse, as it were?
It's so funny that you bring that up. I get that never. I've never had someone be like, but this doesn't rhyme. I have had people, and I hate these people, who are like, I want it to rhyme. Because it's like four times as much work for me, and the poetry is never very good, because like composing on the spot while trying to rhyme the ends of lines with a limited space that auto breaks your lines for you when you get past a certain word count, and like keeping meter in an improvised way that still advances a storyline or an emotional journey is hard. You need a little lab time, I think, for that. You know, I have a lot of like, I play a lot with like near rhymes, and I play a lot with like non-ending rhymes and with like changes in meter. And again, I think that's the sort of musician spoken word side. But yeah, I haven't had anyone. And I think because I read it to them too. I think if I asked them to read it themselves, like your plumber, they would look at it and they'd be like, words on a page, don't want to. But after I type it, and I used to have a disclaimer that I no longer have as much. I think I've just grown out of the like self-consciousness around it. Where I'm like, I'm a better poet than I am a speller, so I'm going to read it to you in case I've misspelled anything. And that reading then becomes important, because they've told me a story, and now I'm telling them their story back. And so I think that in a way there's a very like deep, I'm going to say the word primal, connection to the oral tradition in that, and to this origin of poetry. Facebook told me today that I should like Homer, that Homer might be one of my people to follow. I was like, what is Homer going to tell me on Facebook? But I'm like, good call, Facebook. That's totally what I think in part is happening here, is that we're going back in some ways to a very ancient way of, you know, all of the great epic poems were just some guy telling a king how great he was so that he could get dinner. Like, I can do that. I don't have ethical qualms with that. Seems like the society we live in. Sure, you're awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Do you want to continue with another poem?
Sure, I can do that. I'll read a poem. I don't know. No, I'm not going to do that one. It's sort of an, it's like an election-y poem, and I've done a bunch of stuff with poetry and politics, but I think everyone's probably sick of that by now. I'll read it, because I was just talking about, you know, Greek stuff. This one, I guess, is a kind of fun example of, I forget whether I'd listened to this story on the radio or read it earlier that day, but they had a whole piece on Pompeii and sort of, or no, it wasn't actually on Pompeii. It was on a city that had been like unearthed in someone's basement in Italy, like dug into this basement. And they were like, oh, there's just an intact city down here that we just built on top of. And so this is a poem that I wrote in the midst of the California wildfires in I think it was 2008, at someone's, a wedding reception is after the wedding. What's the thing before the wedding? Engagement party?
Engagement party, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it was that. There was another wedding that I had that evening that got moved because the vineyard that it was supposed to be in was on fire. And we could see the smoke during this one over the house, but that neighborhood hadn't been evacuated. And so they were going forward with this, this engagement, party.
Well, yeah, our wedding, actually, we got married at Alan's house in Malibu, and there was a fire in the Malibu Hills. So the photographer and like some other people that were important for bringing stuff couldn't make it, and we were kind of like waiting and like, do we delay the thing? And that was like, sort of our first introduction to the fire, which is sort of consumes our life at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're doing anything in California, make sure they have like a force majeure and fire, you know, what to do in case of fire clauses.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, there was something interesting because even though it was like this lovely event, the poems were a little bit sharp and people talked to me a lot about the ways that their relationships weren't working. Like, you know, not in tragic ways or anything, but just like that was what was on people's mind is like, what is the smoke cloud? And I didn't put the person's name in the book, so I'm gonna call this one "They Dug Under the City." They dug, and it's page 234. Sorry, Tim. They dug under the city, found columns rising from just beneath the basement, a quiet residential neighborhood of fragments that had lasted centuries. We too built our houses with stones from the temple, pattern mosaics from wine-stained amphorae, split in centuries-old wars, stand hurting and laughing on history. You have painted your face with ashes and glitter for the holidays. Sparkling, you tender sea glass between your fingers, finding the perfect fit for edges worn smooth, sand blasted transparent, longing to become whole again in new configurations. Man, that poem does not have a satisfying ending. That poem just stops, but I like the things it says before it stops.
So what has done this? You've been doing this for 8 years now. What has that done to your sort of personal writing? Do you, is this like your place where you write and then you don't write elsewhere? Or do you write your own work? And do you find it hard to access yourself now? Telling other people's stories for so long.
This is a great topic. So I'm working a lot on writing my own stories and on writing my own poems, and that's something that it's taken me like five or six years to really be like, no, I need to. This is a wonderful tool that I've been using for other people, and I need to use it for myself too. Like, I need to take my own medicine, and like, it's really hard and really painful. And like, hats off to all the lab poets who are in there just like grappling with their own demons. You know, they're real scary. I think that, yeah, this idea of like finding yourself after being in dialogue with a lot of other people is something that I think about a lot. And I do think, you know, there's we're the five people we spend the most time with kind of thing. And I've been thinking a lot about the ways in which this practice in particular has led me to meet so many people and to really deeply invest in their stories for a moment, you know? And I think I'm very good at that. But, like, I'm trying to get better at, you know, like, having regular phone calls with my friends and, like, making sure that I'm seeing people and, like, doing things other than poems. I mean, that's really what it's been. It's like poetry is this invasive weed that has consumed my life, and now I'm, like, taking three writing classes and teaching a couple of different classes and still writing for events and sort of pitching and then trying to do this sort of civic arm with the city of West Hollywood and thinking about what does it mean to work on behalf of a city? What does it mean to say, okay, I want everyone in this city to have an experience with poetry and to have a good experience with poetry, you know, like it's, and to like, it's twofold, right? It's everyone. And then it's also, and poets need to be supported because they're the ones who are going to do this. Like I talk about them in the book as missionaries, this idea that I think what I do is also sort of this missionary work for, you know, for the lab rats. like, have you seen over here what Tim's doing? With this, you know, this journal.
So, Kathy Hong over on Facebook asked a question. It didn't occur to me, but it's I'm curious about it now. Have you ever refused a poem request? Is there anything you won't write about?
I have. I remember it. It was North Hollywood. We were writing at a pizzeria. It was part of NoHo Lit Crawl, so it was technically a literary thing. And this guy comes up to me outside of the pizzeria. Oh man. And he says, would you write a poem that will make my girlfriend get back together with me?
Oh, interesting.
And I said, no, like I don't have that spell and I don't know enough about your story to know if you'd like be responsible with that or if that's a good idea. It's like, I can write a poem for her. I can write a poem about your story. I can write a poem that is you asking her to take you back, but I cannot write a poem that will get her back together with you because that feels irresponsible. Who am I to do that?
Yeah, like, even if you could, I mean,
could, you know, yeah. Like,
what, like that would be too much power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and also like, can a poem do that? There are limits to these things, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So Daniel Mask asks over here, how has the pandemic changed how you do and what you do? Like, it seems like that would be, it seems like it's impossible now almost, right? Like, where are there crowds and who has office parties right now? So what are you doing now?
And also, like, shut them down, please. You know, yeah. No, I will condone that. Like, keep your filthy lucre. It's been different. It's been challenging. I mean, definitely my company Rent Poet has been a back burner project. And I'm so, so fortunate to have a book that came out in June. I'm like, oh, cool, I can do book things. And to have teaching and to be able, a lot of this pandemic, I've been sitting with high schoolers and like helping them write down their feelings, which feels like a valid use of my time. In this moment, and that's been really beautiful, and they've, you know, they've taught me a lot, blah, 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 teacher talk, all that stuff, but it has, and I've been boning up on my skills. Like I said, I'm taking three poetry classes, or maybe I want to say I'm studying with three poets right now, who I respect and who are very different from each other, and that's been really eye-opening and really cool, to just get, like, work on getting better. I really believe that this is a period where laying fallow is not a bad move and is fruitful, you know, in the end.
Have you thought about doing some kind of live streaming thing where you have like sort of office hours as Rent Poet and, you know, people, you can, you know, do something like this right here and, you know, have someone call in and then you write, you know, and we can see your typewriter as you go. I think that would be sort of compelling.
I've done it. Yeah. For all that I'm like, I don't do as much anymore. I still do a heck of a lot. I've done a number of things and I have a number of things that I can talk about. One is, actually coming up this, is it this Saturday or this Sunday, the 26th, at 11 a.m. Pacific time, I am hosting the second, because we already did the first one, Zoom Typewriter Poets Roundtable. And last time we had about 30 folks from all over the country and all over the world who all do this weird thing at the typewriter, but in real space would never have been able to get together and to talk. And so to start meeting people and understanding their practices and their backgrounds and really thinking of this as a literary movement and taking it seriously in that way, because I'm far from the only one to be doing this. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the reasons that I've been successful, I think, is because it's becoming known, but it's still not over yet. You know, like event coordinators are still like, I just heard you can have a poet in the event.
Yeah. Well, I should say we, you know, the very first episode of the Rattlecast was Benjamin Elshire, who does that from New Orleans. And then on, I think it's, December 15th, Sky Jackson does the same thing. Also out of New Orleans. So we're going to have two more, typewriter poets or busking poets or whatever. It's such an interesting thing, to be doing.
Benjamin's so funny. He has no time for me. And I don't know why. But like, man, that guy hates my guts on social
really?
Media.
So well, interesting.
That's... Yeah, we do. There is a little bit. And one of the reasons I'm doing this, I think, maybe, is because I have gotten some pushback and there is some rivalry. And like, typewriter poets aren't always friends. And that's really interesting to me.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to pause for just a second. I've always thought this was going to happen someday. I have this silent clicking mouse. And it's like no cord and everything, and the battery ran out, so I have to get a new battery, or I can't click on anything. So I'll be right back.
Battery time.
So you talk. Well, tell a story or something.
I'll read a poem while you hunt for your battery. what poem am I gonna read? Yeah. Oh, maybe I'll read this. So one of the things I've been like. Working on in the personal poetry arena, this is not a typewriter poem, is writing poems that are more, that are just gayer, you know, like I'm a gay man and I write poems for everyone. And so that is, I feel like the side of me that kind of comes out to play the least in my writing, ironically, because like, yeah. Poets tend to be pretty vocal about their, you know, inner stuff. And I also have been writing recently. When I was 18, I moved to Scotland for college and was there for 4 years, and kind of didn't have a particular plan to come back to the U.S. And so that experience of kind of being, of displacing yourself, you know, like it's not even being displaced. I was like, you wanted this. You did this, and now, you know, no one. Who are you going to be? How are you going to show up? So the working title, this is a new poem, working title for it is My Skin is a Tattoo of the Places I've Been. It's a terrible title. It'll get a better one.
Yeah, my mouse is back, so I can put it up.
Yeah, mouse. All right.
Okay.
And it goes like this. Arms, when did you last tingle this cold? Unbirthed into the North Sea as it spat sunrise and broke winter against our misplaced bodies, pale and spotty 18-year-olds in bumfuck Scotland, all of us drunk on Tesco vodka, shivery, bewitched, belly aching for books, slurring distance or mystery, we huddled a horny mass, grubbing toward the hot chocolate that steamed from the Christian Union's pop-up tent under the ruined castle bluffs. Proffered with thin fingers like a sacrament, like poison, like my mother, Dawn. I scratched out my American tongue to make space for Milky Builder's tea and Love's Labor's Lost Line, say that five times fast, and salt sweet foreskins of boys with strange vocabularies. I made no plan to return. A decade later, I danced from a cryo chamber. -150 degrees Fahrenheit, with a reality star guru in West Hollywood, arms tattooed for each transformation. You did so good for your first time, he tells me, eyelashes frosted white. You didn't even shiver.
Excellent. And that was My Skin is a Tattoo of the Places I've Been. And since I was getting my my battery, I didn't hear the intro. I was wondering, that's one of my favorite poems that I've read of yours from, you know, the collection you sent. Is that a poem that was your own or was that written for somebody else too? I was wondering that when I was looking at it.
No, that was just me, and that's a new one. So I've learned some tricks in the meantime.
Awesome. Well, we're coming up on 7 o'clock, but I'm having a lot of fun. So we're gonna do let's do two more questions, and then one more poem, and then we'll wrap up a little late. But so Kashyana Singh asks, have you ever not been able to write in the moment, like a writer's block, while you had someone waiting for a poem? Have you ever had that? Like, that seems like that's the thing that would like stop me from even trying this is like, or is there a way you always find a way, like the show must go on and it works every time? How does that?
You just got to write badly. That's it. You're like, I have nothing original to say to you, and I'm still going to like put something on the page. What helps a lot is what I'm doing is a lot of found poetry. And someone had asked earlier if I took notes. Depends a little bit on the context if I need them or not, but often I will have a page next to me and I'll be taking notes as people are talking. And what I tend to write down is less like big story items and more specific phrases that strike me, or specific word choices, or like place names are great. Anything that they give me that's really specific to them, because then that makes their poem really theirs. And there's this sense of like sealing, I don't know, I'm going to get Harry Potter with it for a second, but like sealing the poem to them, you know, like no one else is going to understand this one line. This one line is an in-joke for you. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why I feel comfortable posting a lot of the poems I write in this way on Instagram, because I'm like, I came up with some lines that I liked, and also half of the lines in this will only make sense to this one person and like won't mean anything to anyone else. And so it's not like a finished, like the one that I just read, I'm like, this is a poem that I have invested time in and have edited and have really gone through. And I think means something. I'm super excited about the way it means something. It's like being a lab poet. It's lovely. But it's a different process. It's a whole different process.
There's a bunch of more questions I wanted to ask, but one of them I was wondering, do you think that, there's something about this time that makes what you're doing work. Like you mentioned that, I think it's somewhere in the book you say like the commodity is presence, and that you're listening, you know, like everybody's desperate to feel listened to. And there's a way that the technology and social media and like the way we distance ourselves seems maybe different. Do you think that if you had a time machine and went back 100 years, do you think you could still do this? Or is it something like, is it human, or is it like our time?
No, it's okay. Yeah. Such a good question. So there are people who do a version of this in particularly like India and Mexico, at like train stations and bus stations. They're still like on typewriters, and they're there to write letters for people who are not literate, because sometimes you need to send a letter. And I imagine now email has probably, you know, supplanted a lot of these people's jobs. But a lot of people still don't have access to email. So they, you know, that's who they're serving. For someone illiterate to say something to someone far away, right? That's it. And in that case, usually they're directly transcribing. And I think there's a level of like emotional translation. Like, I think that we as a society are so bad at telling each other how we feel that we need a stranger to friggin' intervene on our behalf and be like, hey, you know, this person kind of likes you, you know, married to you for 40 years, here's why. But it's so embarrassing to tell that to someone. Like, I haven't said this before, but maybe it's true. Sincerity has kind of become toxic, which is something that I feel in contemporary poetry sometimes too, where I'm like, okay, another, you know, sort of sassy glib poem. That like I'm a big fan of and I talk about it in the book, like tackiness and kitsch and cliches and all of these like ways that people make meaning in their lives that are, I think, frowned on by people who consider themselves serious culture makers. And I love the idea of taking these things really seriously and saying, no, what if this is, you know, what if we put this in the museum? What happens then?
It's interesting that similar. Either I don't remember if it was the interview in print or the podcast we did, but Pavana Reddy, the Instagram poet that we interviewed for that issue that you were in, talk about how the sort of service to call it a service that Instagram poets provide is to give sort of a way to say something but not really say it, to like share your emotions but like let it have a little distance. And like, is it poems for other people that you write a lot? And you know, like I was saying, like I want to write a poem for this person and then I'm going to give it to them. Does that happen a lot too?
Like in my daily life?
No, like in with your your work here. Like, are you sometimes writing poems that are like, I'm going to give this to the person?
Oh yeah, about probably over half the time. Yeah, probably yeah. 2/3 of the time I'm writing poems that function as gifts, and I love that idea that I am creating a gift for someone. Like, what a nice way to write poetry. What a beautiful intention. I love what you're, I'll have to go back and look for that episode, because I totally started writing poems in part because one time I caught my mom like reading my journal when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing exclusively in like short story fiction and poetry, because it was a way to obfuscate what I was actually saying.
Oh, that's
so interesting. I do like the idea of poetry as obfuscation.
Yeah.
Can't be too direct.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you want to finish out with one last poem before we go?
Sure, I would love to. What do we want to do? Okay. Let's see. Shall we be sentimental and cheesy, or shall we be, wait, sentimental and cheesy? Let's be sentimental and cheesy for a second.
Sounds good.
When quarantine started, it was right before National Poetry Month, which is usually like one of my busiest months. And I just watched this like thing that I had been, you know, building for the last 6 years, just like die because of the world. And not to be depressing about it. And I've done corporate events on Zoom where like people have signed up for a 15-minute slot. I'm super happy. It was, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, I did a fundraiser for the American Public Health Association, and I like wrote a poem summarizing the first half of their event, and then auctioned off me writing poems for people at the event. We raised like $2,000, and I was like, oh, like maybe this is a way that I can do this, is thinking about, because I think it's always embedding yourself in an event. I don't want to have a poetry event because only people who like poetry come to poetry events. I want to have an event that has poetry that people will, you know, you can sneak it on them. All that to say, this is the first poem that I wrote in the pandemic. It took away my writing completely for 2 weeks. I'd been like in a classroom, and we had to finish the residency 2 days early because they were like, we're closing the school. The teachers have to plan for, you know, remote forever. Yeah, and I still feel this one a bit as we're at this stage of pandemic exhaustion. They said stay indoors, and we nomads who'd lived on the salt of the road and the kindness of strangers wondered what our hearts would eat next. We devoured books, filled every corner of ourselves with imagined worlds until we were whole continents. We grew mountainous in our solitude, so tall our eyes crested clouds, and we could see each other again, far off, just floating heads and garbled voices in the thin air. May this book, and I was trying to grapple with coming out with a book in this time. May this book be a compass and a grandfather clock, a measure of time and weight in your palm, a presence in a world that's lost its body. I write to touch my thoughts, a friend tells me. Append the bridge to the physical world. Eat well, stranger friend. When we meet again, we will each contain new multitudes.
Thanks, guys. That was Brian Sonia Wallace with a poem from the spring. They said stay indoors, I guess we can call it. Thanks so much for joining us, Brian. It's really been a pleasure talking to you and just getting all your insights into what you've been doing. It's really fascinating.
Thank you so much. Likewise. I would love to, yeah, I would love to talk more about, it's so funny because part of the weird thing about being interviewed is I'm like, but I'm the one asking the questions. Like, what are you doing and how does it connect? And I'm like, nope. Keep it in. Another conversation, another time.
Well, that's a lot of fun. Well, you'll have to write another book soon, and then we can have you on again.
Will do.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. Good to see you, and have a good rest of your night.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Tim.
Bye. Yes, that was Brian Sonia Wallace with his newest book, The Poetry of Strangers, a book of essays, What I Learned Traveling America with a Typewriter. It's available now from Harper Perennial. And you can find Brian at his websites and social media. All of it is Rent Poet. So, you know, on Instagram, it's Rent Poet. On rentpoet.com is his website. So find him there at Rent Poet and check out this book. It's a really, if you're a lover of poetry, it's an excellent book, excellent read. And, you know, I couldn't put it down kind of today. It was a really good book. A lot of stories with the different people. We didn't even get into the all the different people that he met along the way, which is part of the fascination with it. So if you enjoyed this conversation, please do click the like button right now if you haven't yet. We're going to be going on in just a minute to our open mic show, but there's a lot of people watching live, and you know, like 1/4 of them have click the like. So click the like if you can. I know a lot of people don't have, you know, Google accounts or whatever, so they can't click like, and that's fine too. But click if you can. I appreciate it. Now for the open mic, let's say goodbye to Brian here and put on the open mic numbers. So the prompt for the week was to write a poem about contradictions, so sort of oxymorons and things like that. And if you wrote a poem for the prompt this week, email it if you haven't yet to openmic@rattle.com, all one word, that's openmic@rattle.com. Then send it to send it by email, but then send me a chat message to Rattle Poetry, all one word, over Skype, if you want to join by video, or phone 818-850-7727. Let it ring a few times, then just hang up, and I will call you back when the time is right. That's 818-850-7727. That's how we do it. All you have to do is let it ring a few times. I have a call list, so we have Nivedita is here, Sally Dunn, Brent Stauffer, Carla Schwartz. We got a bunch of other poems by email. I have to go over to that email account first. We got a bunch of people who sent poems by email too. Danny Mask, I see a contradiction poem from him. I saw him in the chat a bunch of times. Joshua Fields. Let's see. Okay, so for my poem this week, I thought that I would try to do the Brian Sonia Wallace thing and try my hand at that. So what I did is, you know, what he does reminds me a lot of, which I didn't mention during the show, but it reminds me a lot of Humans of New York, which if you're not familiar with that, it's a guy who, a photographer, who interviews people and then takes a portrait of them. And it started out on the streets of New York, so you'd sort of hear people's personal stories out in the street, and then he's gone all over the world. It's one of the most popular Facebook accounts. And you know, really one of the most popular, you know, things going on, sort of a new medium. And so I thought that was very similar to kind of what Brian's getting at with his poems. So I went to the Facebook page for Humans in New York, and I decided I would write a poem in 10 minutes based on whatever the first person said, and based on their story, as if I was writing a poem for them. And so I tried to do that using these contradictions, like the prompt was saying, and it was hard. It's not easy doing what Brian Sonia Wallace does, but here's my attempt. And it actually took, as my kids pointed out, they were watching in the back as I was doing it, and they said, "You took 13 minutes, Dad. It wasn't 10." So they were they called me out. But this is a 13-minute poem, "Alone Together," and this was a woman who, if you go to the Humans of New York Facebook page right now, it's the most recent one. It's a woman who, you'll hear the story here, but she met her sort of best friend for life on her wedding trip or her honeymoon trip to Acapulco. And they both ended up getting divorced, but they're best friends forever now. And this is sort of her story with as many oxymorons as I could squeeze in there. alone together. It was an open secret, not the look on your face, but the rock on your finger. Happily married or just, same difference. Us two, a pair of jumbo shrimp halfway to nowhere, Acapulco. Our husbands were cliff dives into melted ice, a long trip down an escalator, all mud bath and freezer burn. Good grief. But there you were, like a fine mess of fuzzy logic, proving it all a deliberate mistake. Best friends forever, we'll take big sips of our cosmos and end on a relaxing hike, a tragic comedy crash landing on free love. That is my attempt at doing what Brian Sony Wallace does, and I put it in a typewriter kind of font too, but man, that was hard. Megan's poem, as usual, is better than mine. This is Megan's poem for display. I think it's wax fruit was what she was going at, or maybe for display, but here it's for display. In the village, everything was made of wax. Nobody knew it. I'm as real as a pig in dirt, they would say. But it was all wax, the people, the buildings, the food. Only the fruit was real, but nobody would eat it because they said it tasted like wax. So that's Megan's poem, for display, from the contradictions prompt for this week. And now it is your turn. Let's see what everybody else has to share with us today. Let's call up Sally Dunn first. And we will find Sally's poem as we go. Phone is ringing, and I have Sally's poem here. Hey, Sally, how are you doing tonight?
Doing okay.
And so what was your sort of contradiction? How did you approach this prompt this week?
Well, I started out with this basic simple idea of plants growing in a greenhouse that didn't have any light, and ended up with kind of a so I'll just read it. The greenhouse. They grow under black painted glass, a pink sunflower, a fruit tree laden with Christmas ornaments, a vine crawling the floor on millipede legs. They all suck life out of the body planted on the ceiling. Strapped to the ceiling, I writhe as they devour me, my pink-haired mother, my father with his ornaments passed down for generations, and him. He touches me everywhere with his fuzzy feet, down my throat, along my bones, swaggering through my veins. His mouth daintily sups on my heart, dabbing his mouth with a pure white napkin. My husband dines on me. My tears feed my mother, my father, and the faceless others, thriving in dark corners. I know their names, all of them. They slipped into my life as if they had a right. I smile, the small smile of one whose secret is seconds from revelation. My tears are toxic, the meat of my heart poison. Their deaths are upon them. They died long ago.
That was The Greenhouse by Sally Dunn. Very interesting, Sally. You kind of went deep with that, and you use your imagination there. Thanks for sharing that.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good night. Oops, didn't mean to cut her off. Let's call up Brent Stauffer. Except he's not answering. Where's Brent? We'll call Brent in just a little bit. Let's do Carla Schwartz. So the phone's ringing for Carla.
Hi.
Hey, Carla.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
How are you, Tim?
I'm great. Yeah, that was a very fun show. I really enjoyed it, and looking forward to hearing your poem.
Oh, thank you so much. So this is it's called November Swim, and it was inspired by swimming in cold water, which I do, and the conflicts that you might feel because the one contradiction, literal contradiction I put in there is the term frigid burn, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So November swim. Quick, step back into the pond before you change your mind. Feel the chill seep in along your spine before the layer of water between skin and neoprene starts to warm. turn your face toward whatever you dread. Skim your forehead through the surface as you stroke arm by arm. Know that for only moments, though moments linger on, you must endure the pain of frigid burn until, what is it, numbness? As you cross the barrier of time, of temperature, you feel the heat in your core.
Excellent poem. That's thanks. It. Yeah, thanks for sharing. Okay. It reminds me of growing up, there was a Stony Brook Creek, which where the water was always 32.1 degrees. So it wasn't, and then we also, you know, all the kids would challenge themselves to jump in and swim to one side and back. Thanks for sharing that. It really brought back memories, Carla.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Nivedita's poem. This is, of course, Nivedita Karthik, who lives in India. And she's already at work now because it's about, what time is it, like 8 a.m. or something in India. But she wrote a poem called Contradictions. And let's share it for you now. This is Contradictions by Nivedita Karthik. Here we go. Contradictions. Oxymoronic contradictions exist. The biggest one yet is oxymoron. Others include deafening silence, like the moment you realize your voice is worth nothing, or the only choice, like the one you were given when asked to leave, or even the walking dead, which is how you feel as you step away, never to return. But life is now weirdly normal. Oxymorons exist all around. The boy with the warm chocolate eyes, but heart as cold as a glacier. The woman who wept tears of joy when she realized how awfully good it was to be left alone. Then, clearly confused, you look inside yourself, and that wide-open secret reveals itself, your oxymoronic self. For, although the brightest of smiles grace your face, the deadness in your eyes never fades away. That was Nivedita Karthik. She's a graduate in immunology at the University of Oxford and works as a freelance editor and a reviewer over in India. So thanks for sharing that, Nivi. Always great to hear your poems. let's see. Okay, so Brent's trying to call us back. Let me try Brent one more time. Let's see if this works this time. Here he is. Hey, how you doing today? Hello? Yeah, good. You're on.
Wow. Thank you so much for persevering. I don't know what was going on.
Yeah, no problem. It's the technology. It's a miracle that it works. That's how I think every single day that we do this show. We've done 67 shows, and I've never had a guest not work. You know, I don't know how it, like, it's just magic. It's like literal magic.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's right. Because, well, Arthur C. Clarke just described magic as technology we don't understand.
Yeah.
And this is that.
This is definitely technology. It's a series of tubes in our pictures across the tubes.
Yeah. You know, that guy that we all made fun of for saying that, that senator, turns out he was kind of right.
He was, yeah.
and that people who really know about this sort of thing all went, that's right.
So what do you got for us? This is Nietzsche in Love.
Okay, yeah. I was in the kerfuffle. I have lost my glasses, but I will persevere as well. The contradiction initially was simply that Nietzsche was in a very happy period of his life when he wrote a book called The Birth of Tragedy. And I thought, well, that's funny.
Yeah.
And then I looked into The Birth of Tragedy, which I have not read, but I looked into it, and it's about the birth of the tragedy as a form in ancient Greece, and about how by embracing our suffering, we can find meaning in our lives and even joy. And I figured, well, that's pretty contradictory. I was talking to my friend who says, did you know that Nietzsche was in love with Wagner's wife?
I did not know that.
Yeah, who was the daughter of Liszt, by the way. And so I'll wrap this up. It's about that triangle, kind of, and it's about the contradiction of finding joy in suffering. It's very referential, and I don't like referential poems. but I wrote one anyway. So,
okay, well, let's see. Go ahead.
Okay, here it is. How I chortled during the birth of tragedy. Every time Oedipus killed his dad, I'd guffaw. Of course I wept and railed. You know me. But then, with a merry grin only scofflers could consistently achieve, I'd drink mightily ecstatic blood from the cup of old Dionysus. It took both hands to raise it to my grimace. Dance with me, bitter-wise Schopenhauer. Shake those wispy white locks at the sun. The funeral bells tell me it's happy hour. Let's leave the widows to their lamentations. Agamemnon is setting fire to the old tower. Oh, Cosim, you married Wagner while I was at war. I laugh now and sing this song. You know what for.
Excellent. Thanks. That was a lot of fun. Thanks for sharing that, Brent.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, so we got one last phone call while we're talking to Brent. Let me make sure. Yeah, I think this is going to be the last one. It's a 215 number. We'll see who is there before we call it a night. Hey, this is Tim with Rattle. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, who am I talking to?
I'm Joshua Fields.
Hey, Joshua. Yeah, I thought so, because you just sent your poem pretty recently.
Yeah.
Let me put it into a Word doc really quick. There you go. So what was your contradiction? How did you approach this prompt? Hang on one second. I hear myself in the background. Can you click that out so it's not like confusing? Like mute that. Okay, much better.
Perfect.
Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah. So how did you approach this prompt?
So I mean, I took the prompt more to like a literal sense, more of just things, you know, concepts in the world and ideas in the world. So usually most of my poetry is just like really just like literal. So like just to the point.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. Let me put it up for everybody and go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay, awesome. So I kind of made the poem like last minute. So I titled it Contradictions. So I'll go ahead and read it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it says, you want to talk about contradictions? I'm going to share with you. It's the life we live in. Like a heavy novel, turn the page, it's fiction. You never know what happens next. Make a prediction. Things that don't make sense, we make assumptions. Like a priest unfaithful to God, that's unheavenly. Trying to preach scripture, but lacks loyalty. A cheating husband in a marriage, call it infidelity. Promised vows now broken, what stupidity. Bad leadership in a president, that's corruption. Talking smack on TV, bad influence, wicked seduction. Going hungry for the rich is total dysfunction. Complaints are common on the menu, no compassion. Being a doctor with no degree is a misunderstanding. Employment is competition. Sadly, it's tragic. A bright sun in the star night sky cannot happen. A solar eclipse is a thing, scientifically fantastic. You can't say summertime in the winter. It doesn't function. Besides, snowmen don't swim well, personification. You see, many things seem to be opposites. Even when we speak, we can contradict. Makes the world confusing, complex, with no sense. But these are just thoughts I wrote, and that's past tense.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. That was Joshua Fields with Contradictions. Joshua, where are you calling from? I forgot to ask.
Oh, I am calling from Maryland, but my number is from Philadelphia, so I'm originally from Philadelphia.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I'm so glad you could join us and share that. It's a great poem and very different from the others. I love that.
Thank you.
Awesome. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay, that was Joshua Fields. Let me put him in the our little contact list to make sure we know who he is next time. Always love first-time callers. Okay. And I believe that is our show for tonight. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. I had a lot of fun with this episode, and I hope you did too. Now, next week's guest on the Rattlecast is going to be Steve Henn. And he has a new book that just came out, and then his book before that, Indiana Noble Sad Man of the Year. Steve Henn is one of the... don't know, we've published him a whole bunch of times. He's one of the, you know, one of the things that we look for in poems a lot is humor, because it's hard to find humor. And we find a lot of humor in Steve Henn. And looking forward to talking to him next week. That is Radcast number 68. And I just realized I forgot to tell you the prompt poems. Let me tell you the prompt poem. I caught myself in time. The prompt for next week is going to be randomstreetview.com is a site that randomly generates photographs of streets all over the world. Find a photo that speaks to you there and write a poem about it. So go to randomstreetview.com, and it's spelled just like it sounds, randomstreetview.com. Find a picture there of a street view and write a poem about that street view. So kind of a classic poem, but a sort of a futuristic street view version of frastic poetry. This is exciting. I'm looking forward to this prompt. It's going to be a lot of fun. So go to randomstreetview.com, find a random photograph of a street view somewhere in the world, maybe like make the epigram or something where it actually is, so that you know, that'd be cool, and then write a poem about that. So that'll be your prompt for next week, and once again, next week's guest is going to be Steve Henn, Rattlecast number 68, the usual time, Tuesday, November 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern. Hope to see you then. Hope you had a good night tonight, and hope you have a good rest of your week. Good night.